on the 130 docket is the Mountain States against Hauser case. Counsel, when you are comfortable and seated, you may proceed as you wish.
May it please the court. I am Ralph Ogden. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Heidi Hauser. We're asking that the court reverse the decision of the trial court and find that there was coverage for the injuries sustained by Ms. Hauser as a result of the sexual assault by Luke, Gondrysek. I'd like to begin my argument by stating an obvious legal principle, because I think it's important to keep that principle in mind as the court analyzes the policy at issue. And that principle is that the court is sitting as a, in effect, sitting as a trial court when it conducts a de novo review of the record. I think the de novo review is extremely important because it means that you're showing no deference to the decision of the trial court, and indeed the decision of the trial court is irrelevant to what this court does, because this court looks independently from scratch at the record, the facts, and at the law that existed in the district court. This case, I think, involves a clause of a general liability policy that I've found no precedent on, and that is the separation of insureds clause. And under that clause, the coverage of one insured has no relationship, no interdependence, no dependence on the coverage of another insured. I think that is the only reasonable reading of that clause. That means that the question of whether there is coverage for Mulligans is separate and independent from the question of whether there is coverage for Gondrysek. I would not dispute that there is no coverage for Gondrysek because it was clearly an intentional tort on his part. But that doesn't answer the question of whether you have to analyze separately the question of coverage for Mulligans, and I think that that is necessary under that clause. Mulligans was sued under a separate theory than Gondrysek. Mulligans was sued on a theory that it negligently hired, negligently retained, and negligently failed to supervise Gondrysek. And Colorado recognizes the court, the torts of negligent hiring and negligent supervision. I believe it would also recognize the court, the tort of negligent retention, if it were given the opportunity to do so. Under the reasoning of the Supreme Court, when it's decided those cases, the court has held that it is essentially a negligence claim and that it involves a claim that the employer acted or failed to act in a manner that a reasonable employer would have acted or failed to act under the same or similar circumstances.
Mr. Ogden, why would you need a tort of negligent retention in this case? Wouldn't the negligent hiring be enough?
Yes, it would.
Okay.
I'm simply repeating what was pled in the underlying correction. Right. I think negligent hiring is sufficient.
Okay.
And I think the reasoning behind the court's decisions on negligent hiring and negligent supervision is that under ordinary circumstances, the master is not liable for intentional torts of the servant. And by allowing negligent hiring, negligent supervision claims, the court is allowing relief to tort victims against the master when there would not be a remedy otherwise available.
Does it have to be foreseeable to the master that the employee would commit the tort?
Yes. I think that's inherent in the concept of negligence.
Does it have to be expected?
No.
How do you draw the distinction between what is foreseeable and what is expected then?
Well, foreseeability involves a balancing of risk, and what you're doing is it's an objective standard. Would a reasonable person under the same or similar circumstances foresee that this was a likely or possible outcome? An expected outcome is one, as the Supreme Court said in the Hecla mining case, expected or intended is a result that the insured knew would result from, would directly and immediately result from its intentional conduct.
Should have known?
No, not should have known. Should have known is not part of the expected or intended test under Hecla Mining.
So then what do we do with the allegations that Ms. Hauser made in her underlying case against Mulligans and the findings that the trial court made? She alleged that Mulligans knew, I don't know if I'm pronouncing, knew of Gondrzek's dangerous propensities because of his violent and abusive behavior, knew that Gondrzek was under investigation for, I guess, sexual assault, knew that there had been a prior incident where he'd assault another employee. Doesn't that meet the definition you just gave us of expected?
I don't think so. First, I think that the allegations of the complaint are irrelevant, and the question that the court needs to consider is what was the evidence in this case. I think those are simply allegations that the plaintiff made in the underlying tort case. I think they complicate the court's consideration, but I don't think they're binding in terms of determining what evidence there was before the district court in this case about Mulligan's knowledge.
The court found, and I'm reading from that order of damages, that Mulligan's knew full well what was potentially going to happen with their son, referring to Gondrzek, and the female employees, and did not care. What do we do with that finding?
Well, I think that finding goes to the question of punitive damages, which I think that's interesting dicta, but I think that's all it is dicta by the district court, because punitive damages could not have been awarded in this case without violating the automatic stay provision. And again, that was a default judgment. There was no evidence before the court of the intent or the knowledge of Mulligan's.
Well, my understanding is because there was an evidentiary hearing, some evidence was put on.
Well,
I know it wasn't contested, but there was some hearing, was there not?
We don't know what the hearing involved, what evidence was offered, because the transcript wasn't made a part of the record in this case. My understanding, which is nothing more than my understanding, is that there was a default judgment entered, and that default judgment on liability was followed by a hearing on damages.
So the trial court accepted the allegations as true?
Yes, without there being.
And there's no need for us to reject that finding in a de novo review of the application of law.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, we don't have a witness box.
No.
And so we, in a de novo review, we look at the law and the application of the law.
Yes.
And we look at trial court's findings and accept those.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor.
In a de novo review of a default judgment?
Well, you're not reviewing a default judgment. You're reviewing a decision by the district court in a separate case that involves a coverage question, but you're not reviewing the default judgment. And I think that's an important distinction.
And so we have to accept, for purposes of applying the coverage questions as a matter of law, we have to accept as true the allegations that were found, as a matter of fact, by the trial court. It's not a motion for summary judgment that we're reviewing here.
You are reviewing the motion for summary judgment. You're not reviewing the default.
Okay.
I don't know if I've addressed your question.
I think you have.
Okay. the default was entered in a completely separate case, and it was simply that. It was a default. There was no evidence that we know of in this record. There is no evidence other than the fact that there was a default entered.
But those were your client's allegations, and it was your clients that sought the damages and made the evidentiary showing to obtain the damages.
That is correct, Your Honor. The Mountain State cites three cases to support its claim that the intentional act of one insured is the intentional act of another. And all three of those cases involve intentional torts by employees and claims against insurance coverage that was held in the name of the employer. Three cases are the 1906 company case out of the Fifth Circuit, the Salazar case out of the Tenth Circuit, and the Mutual of Human Claw case versus Wilcox out of the Supreme Court of Idaho. And I'd like to distinguish those cases because I think it's important that the court understand what the reasoning of all three of those courts were. First and foremost, neither of those cases addressed the separation of insureds clause, which we have in this case. They simply didn't talk about separation of insureds, and I don't know from reading the opinions whether there was such a clause in those policies or not. I think the cases also confuse cause with proximate cause, and I think that's an important distinction. In all three of those cases, the court said that the cause, and it just simply used the word, in each case it used the word cause, the cause of the plaintiff's claimed injuries was the intentional tort of the employee. I think that a more correct reasoning, and certainly a reasoning applicable under Colorado law, is that the proximate cause of Heidi Hauser's injuries was the intentional tort of Luke Gondryzak. But I think a contributing cause was also the negligence of Mulligan's in placing Mr. Gondryzak in circumstances where he could commit the intentional tort. It's the but-for test, but for the negligence of Mulligan's in placing him in that situation, the plaintiff would not have been injured. She would not have been assaulted, but for that negligence. So you have, in effect, concurrent causes. You have an intentional tort, and you also have the negligence of the employer.
Let's take the Salazar case for a minute. Salazar was trying to determine what the meaning under an insurance policy was of the term occurrence, which is exactly the same thing we're faced with here, is it not?
Yes.
And it found that an occurrence, to determine what is an occurrence, the question is has to be resolved by focusing on the injury and its immediate attendant causative circumstances, which here it would have been the sexual assault, isn't that right? Under Salazar, the occurrence was the boy shooting the other boy with a gun. The negligent act happened well before that when the mother entrusted the boy with the gun.
The court in Salazar, like the court in the other two cases, did not approach the case from the point of view of negligence by principle. It simply said that the occurrence was the precipitating event, and I would submit that you can have more than one occurrence, particularly in light of the separation of insurance clause. In this case, one occurrence involved the negligent hiring, the negligent supervision of Mr. Gondryzak. That is an occurrence, or a continuing series of events that place people in the path of harm under the definition of occurrence in the policy. Negligent hiring was a specific discrete event that is separate and distinct from the occurrence which caused the injury. I'd like to reserve my remaining 39 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Ocken. Mr. Zupkus?
Good afternoon.
Isn't this an appeal of a declaratory judgment that arose as a result of cross motions for summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so the parties stipulated to a set of facts, did they not?
There were undisputed facts, the basis of which were the underlying complaint that Ms. Hauser filed against Mulligans.
And since the underlying complaint was reduced to judgment under a default judgment, don't we have to accept those facts as true?
I believe you do. And I believe that that is the sole core of the undisputed, or the facts in this case, the undisputed facts.
Okay.
And may please the court and counsel. For the record, my name is Robert Zupkus on behalf of Mountain States Mutual. And with me here is Mr. David Hilliard of the company. He is the Colorado Claims Supervisor. And in this particular case, I think we can all say with complete sincerity that we have sympathy for what Ms. Hauser went through in terms of her injury suffered at the hands of Mr. Grzondelik, literally. And the fact that she had enough damages that a trial court awarded a verdict against Mulligans in excess of $873,000. But the entry of that judgment is not the deciding factor of what triggers coverage in this case or not. And when you look at what the insurance policy is, it was a voluntary contract between Mulligans and Mountain States Mutual. It was not mandated coverage. It was a commercial general liability policy. It was a policy that is designed to protect Mulligan from financial loss, if you will, should its conduct injure the public at large. It is not designed to protect against intra-company actions or inactions as between employees, which occurred here. And when looking at the policy, one has to go through the simple steps of analyzing an insurance policy. First, you need to have an occurrence. And an occurrence is something, as the cases point out, is something that's an accident. And as pointed out in the the recent general security case versus Mountain States Mutual, it's a fortuitous loss. It's not something that is intended or expected from the standpoint of the insured. And we're looking at the expectation or intention of the insured being Mulligans here. And in this particular case, you need both the occurrence and you have to make sure that there are no exceptions or exclusions which are triggered which would remove the coverage. And in this particular case, we believe that neither test has been satisfied so as to overturn the well-reasoned opinion of Judge Schapansky. In this case, there was no occurrence. There was only an expected event from the standpoint of Mulligans. And this is what was repeated several times in the complaint that Ms. Hauser filed against Mulligans. She said that the defendant, Grzondelik, was under investigation for sexually assaulting three other young women at the time he assaulted the plaintiff. And defendant Mulligans knew or should have known of his dangerous propensities in their hiring of him, retaining him, etc. And she makes that statement not once, but several times throughout the complaint. It's the real focus of her complaint, that the assault was essentially something that was that Mulligans knew or should have known what that was going to happen. And that was something that was picked up by Judge Schapansky in his order when he said, and also the underlying trial court, which awarded the judgment, which said that Mulligans knew or should have known what was going to happen and frankly didn't care. So from the standpoint of Mulligans, there was no occurrence. There was only an expected event. And with knowledge, when you look at the Hecla case, it becomes an expected or intended event. If the insured has knowledge of the injury that's going to flow from the acts, then you have an expected or intended event. And that's exactly what happened here. In addition to that, there are exclusions besides the fact that there was no fortuitous event in this case. One of the exclusions, as we've mentioned several times, is that there is no coverage for expected or intended acts. That's exclusion number one.
Mr. Zulkas, excuse me for interrupting the flow of your argument, but would the result be different if the plaintiff here had alleged duty of care owed to the general public as well as to patrons of the restaurant in the hiring of their employees?
No, the result would not be the same. There would still be a judgment against Mulligan's, but there would still be no insurance coverage. And that is, if nothing else, again, goes to the heart of this commercial general liability policy, which is not a workers' compensation policy. And essentially, there's an exclusion in the policy for events related to the employment situation or liability flowing from the employment situation. There are actually two separate exclusions on the employment topic. One is called the, excuse me one moment, Judge. One is the employment-related practices, and then the employer's liability exclusion. The latter essentially is basically says that if there's an employer's liability, that essentially is, it really is, falls to workers' compensation. The employment-related practices exclusion also says that anything that flows out of the employment situation is excluded. And for example, the employer's liability exclusion says there's no bodily injury to employees of the insured arising out of and in the course of employment by the insured.
Mr. Zulkas, let me ask you a question about that. I'm looking at that provision of the policy right now. It falls right below the workman's comp exclusion.
Yes.
The workman's comp exclusion, we understand. The employee's covered by workman's comp. They can't sue their employer. What does this second exclusion add to the workman's comp exclusion?
Well,
that's not already excluded, I guess. I'm trying to understand this exclusion.
Well, I believe that the exclusion is because, again, you read the policy as a whole and it follows on the heels of the workers' compensation exclusion. I believe that these are basically side-by-side exclusions. And then there is, on the previous page, the, there's a separate endorsement called the employment-related practices exclusion, which is a separate exclusion saying that bodily injury is excluded for employment-related practices, policies, or omissions. And then it gives a few examples.
Well, stick with me a minute on the employer liability exclusion.
Yes, sir.
It says it excludes bodily injury to an employee, as you read, of the insured, arising out of or in the course of employment. First question, do we use workman's comp law to determine what the meaning of arising out of and in the course of employment is, or do we have to go to some other body of law?
I think you go by the common definitions. I don't think you have to necessarily, from this exclusion, go to workers' compensation. But I would say, and I would submit, that that would have been her proper remedy.
To go to workman's comp?
Yes.
All right. Second thing is arising out of and in the course of employment, are those two different things or are they the same thing?
I believe that they are two different things. In other words, they're arising, I mean, it says and, it's not or.
In this case, the trial court judge found this exclusion applicable.
Yes.
Right? Because he found that, I gather he found, that the injury did not arise out of or it was not in the course of her employment. You don't dispute that it arose out of her employment, do you?
No.
She would not have been at Mr. Gondrzik's house but for her employment, right?
As she alleged, that's the sole reason she went there.
And she went there to discuss tips or stealing tips.
Correct.
Was that in the course of her employment?
It was part of it was the sole reason that she went there to see her supervisor, Mr. Grzondalek, to talk about it. And even though she was off the clock, it was still arising out of her employment. That's
I understand that, but because she wouldn't have known him but for that, but was it in the course of her employment since she was off the clock? The workman's comp cases talk about, you know, time and place and that sort of thing. I'm trying to figure out how the judge found that it was in the course of her employment and therefore this exemption applied or exclusion applied.
Because, well, for two reasons. Again, she may have known that, I mean, she obviously knew Mr. Grzondalek, but she didn't go there for any other purpose except employment matters. She didn't go there to, for example, have a cup of tea, pick up a book she left off for him to read or anything like that. It was solely related to the stealing of tips and solely because he was the supervisor. And when we look back at what happened again in terms of the pleadings in the what I will call the tort action and what the trial court did there, the trial court found that the conduct of Mulligans was willful and wanton, and Ms. Hauser got what she wanted from the trial court there. She got a judgment which included punitive damages, and she got a finding that Mulligans knew full well what was what potentially was going to happen with their son and female employees. She never protested the terms of the underlying order. She never said, no, this is not what I meant. What she alleged in her complaint against Mulligans was exactly what she got in the order issued by that particular trial court. And then taking a look at the four corners of the complaint that she did file in terms of matching it with the insurance policy coverage, we clearly come to the conclusion that there was no accident, there was no fortuitous event, and even if there had been an occurrence, the exclusions apply related to the fact that this was employment, and the policy clearly has these several exclusions which pick up and exclude employment-related things, because this is not the purpose of a commercial general liability package. It is primarily designed to protect the outside world, not employees.
If we find that there was no occurrence here, we don't even need to reach the exclusions, do we?
That's correct.
Is there any Colorado law, and I saw none cited in your brief, that interprets occurrence in a context like this of a negligent hiring resulting in an intentional tort?
No.
There's no Colorado law?
That's correct.
The closest case you found is Salazar, and I think a case involving a taxi cab in San Francisco. I don't remember the name of the case.
Yes.
Okay.
That basically, Your Honor, we ask that this court uphold the well-reasoned decision of Judge Schapansky and confirm that there is no coverage under the Mountain States mutual policy for the judgment which was entered against Mulligans. And again, for the record, we think that that was a well-reasoned opinion and can serve as a roadmap for the thinking of this court. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sufkis.
Thank you.
Mr. Ogden?
Thank you, both counsel, for your arguments. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. The bailiff may announce a brief recess, and we will reconvene in about 5 minutes to consider the 2:30 docket.
All rise. Court will be in recess.